then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's July the 16th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. I'm going to begin this week with a brief recap of some things I said last week, and which kind of came into play on the occasion of the 4th Radio Free Northwest call-in show, which I uploaded to northwestfront.org on Saturday. I stated at that time that from now on, there would be no quote-unquote crazy talk on the show, and I got a couple of emails from people asking me to define crazy talk a little better. Let me run this down for you again, guys, because this may end up causing a bit of bad blood in the future when our people think I'm censoring them and denying them their right to free speech and all that. Now, I am not at all comfortable in the role of censor, since I've been the victim of it so many times myself in the past, but this new methodology, let's call it, is something that's very necessary, so let me take this from the top for you once again. We've known for years that this podcast is routinely monitored, or audited, I think is the official term now, by the American Secret Police. By that term, I mean not just the FBI, but the whole gamut of alphabet soup agencies, all of whom are now cashing in on the multi-billion dollar anti-terrorist industry in this country and throughout the Western world. DHS, NSA, Secret Service, CIA, U.S. Marshals, the ridiculously misnamed Justice Department, NCIS, and Naval Intelligence, who appear to be particularly fascinated by us, possibly due to the nuclear subs sitting parked just up the sound here. They get the idea. Plus, God knows how many state agencies and NGOs, like the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center, they all earn their daily bread, if that's the word, by guarding the muggles from the horrible, wicked terrorists under their beds and hiding in their closets at night. Now, the fact that for all practical purposes there is no terrorism in the United States, at least not of any organized political kind, makes not a jot of difference to these people. They don't deal in facts, they deal in budget. Hundreds of thousands of government employees have no intention of letting the facts get in the way of that Niagara of taxpayer dollars that roars into their departments and their wallets every year. Okay, that's one thing. Now, these people are dangerous to us, yes. After all, they do have guns. Especially the FBI, in that when they receive their orders from their political masters to destroy me or the party or anyone else, they will carry out those orders without a qualm of conscience. When that happens, the fact that it is morally wrong to destroy other human beings simply for disagreeing with Barack Hussein Obama and the Democratic Party will be conspicuous by its absence from their thinking. These men and women are completely lacking in any kind of moral compass at all. If they were capable of holding moral principles, by definition they wouldn't be in federal law enforcement, or they would have resigned or been weeded out in their first few weeks at Quantico. The system is designed that way on purpose. The ruling party issues an FBI agent with his or her morality at the same time they're issued with a badge and a gun, and that morality is highly mutable. But they are mercenaries, pure and simple. Until the day that order comes for them to hunt down and destroy us, they'll simply sit in their cubicles, listen to their RFNs, write up weekly reports, and then go home at night, or wherever FBI agents go at night. Somehow it's hard to imagine such abnormal people having any kind of so-called normal life, but I suppose that's what some of them sign on for, since they're going to be among the last Americans to be able to enjoy such a life before the rotted planks finally give way and the whole crumbling edifice collapses. Anyway, as I said last week, in the course of their normal spying duties, these men and women do not publicize what they hear on here in either a negative or positive way. Rather the reverse. They're kind of like neutrons in an atom, so to speak. But now we have a whole different class of hostile listeners to Radio Free Northwest. I refer to powerful left-wing media outlets like The Guardian and Politico.com and the dozen or so lesser fry who scooped up their articles, basically reworded and plagiarized them, and republished them. These people have already used the words spoken by me and others on Radio Free Northwest and in the comments section of the Homeland blog in an attempt to do harm. What this means is that from now on, I have to exercise extreme care in what goes out on the air on this program. It means I have to examine the content carefully with a view to any possible use it might be to the enemy if published out of context and used to incite hatred and harm to us. This isn't hard to understand, and in any case, that's just the way things are going to be from now on. In the fourth call-in show I uploaded on Saturday, I ended up having to cut some of the conversation out of the raw footage. Most notably, a 6 or 7 minute segment in which a political topic was discussed, which in my carefully considered opinion is something that we don't need to be discussing in public. In the first place, it has to do with something going on overseas, which is of no relevance to anything here in our own racial struggle. In the second place, it is an issue of great political nuance and complexity, and us American white boys don't do nuance and complexity. We don't have the cultural or the educational chops for it. Ronald McDonald is no damn good at geopolitical statecraft. It confuses us. Hell, it confuses me, and from what I can observe, it damn sure confuses the people involved. If we allow it to take over our conversation, as the liberals say, it is one of those issues that will generate an infinite amount of heat and very little light. When we want to do that, we can just talk about religion like we always do. Now, one of our many terrible habits in our wee little movement is we latch on to some how many stormtroopers can dance on the head of a pin type subject, and we obsess over it until we are screaming abuse at one another on the internet and waging lifelong blood feuds over nothing. This is one of the many techniques that we use to avoid the thing that we fear most, having to knock off the bullshit and get down to work and deal with the actual reality of our present crisis of civilization, here, now, right in front of us, and not comfortably far off in another country somewhere, over the sea, and deal with that real and immediate crisis in ways which entail personal risk and inconvenience. We will do anything, allow ourselves to be sidetracked by anything, in order to not do that. I am not going to allow that to happen on Radio Free Northwest or with the Northwest Front. Well, that topic is off limits, and there will be others. And no, I won't tell you what it is, because that would initiate the very discussion we're going to avoid. People, we need to keep our eyes on the prize here. We need to stay focused, and we need to remember what we're all about, the 14 words of David Lane. Next up is a short audio file from two of our comrades, which is of special significance, which I'll explain afterwards.
Greetings, comrades. This is Comrade Adam from Milwaukee, Oregon with
Nevitz.
And Nevitz just came down here to visit, and we actually made contact with each other in the real world, like what we're supposed to be doing. We actually had dinner last night and breakfast this morning. Thank you for paying for that, by the way, Steve.
You're welcome.
And if you look at Steven, it's Nevitz backwards, so think stuff up like that if you want to take some security precautions. So basically what the most important thing that we did today was we actually met each other in the real world and had a conversation. And I've also done work with one of our other guys down here in passing out flyers at a gun show. And what we need to do is have enough courage to do legal actions where we're at least talking to each other in the real world in a diner for, what, an hour?
An hour or so, yeah.
Yeah, anything else you want to put in here?
Yeah, I do. I want to talk about why we're so dangerous, or why they think we're so dangerous. And the reason that is just because of people like me and Adam. Because we're not going to go out there and wear a uniform so that we can be identified. We don't go out in public and say nigger too loud so we can be identified. And we have patience, which is very dangerous. We're not going to do anything prematurely. And now that we've met and we trust each other, we're going to take it from here and grow further. And I'm very happy I made the trip. It was about a 2.5 hour drive for me. And this part of Oregon's really nice. A lot of white people down here. I love it. Not too many niggers or beaners or whatever. It's really nice. And everyone should put in the effort to travel and meet and put out email addresses like Adam did.
And there you go, Steve. And I really wanted to do this, guys. It was really fun. It's easy and it's polite. I wish I could have paid for more, but I'm kind of strapped for cash right now. So I'm going to sign off right now and leave my more contact info. Some effort in my own education, or the public school system, which is at least somewhat decent here, but I took it above and beyond because That's what white boys gotta do to build a homeland. So, that's it. I'll be back later. Bye.
Nigger, 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 nigger.
Nigger, nigger, nigger.
This is Adam from Milwaukee, and...
This is Nevitz from Olympia, Washington.
And we had to do that to teach you guys how to say nigger if you still say black folk or whatever, motherfucker.
Black person.
So, let's do this for beaners. Speck, 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 or whatever word you want to substitute in there, such as beaner. So just say it out loud. Say it in your breath. Say it in your mind. Just say it somehow.
Or come up with a code word. Me and my boys, we call them Scheißaffen. Look it up, or anyone speaks German, Scheißaffen. That's what me and my boys call them in public, because no one knows what that means.
Or say Kaffir, because they also can't comprehend that, like what I do.
Yeah, I didn't even know what that was till about half an hour ago. That's funny.
See, we're learning things. So, get together, talk, learn things. It's great, guys. Come up with code words, make plans, try to get in contact with people. It's fun.
Having a great time here, talking. I'm glad Adam's on our side because I think he's going to be quite useful. Harold, keep on doing what you're doing. Get people to meet. Everybody, meet. Brian from Illinois, get out here. Everyone in Connecticut, get out here. I know my brother's listening in Connecticut. Get out here. Everybody, get your asses out here. Listen to the trucker.
And for all you woodchucks, join up with the NF. Be a man among men. Sign up and let's get this show on the road. And HAC, I want to put a shout out for a lot of Irish rebel music to kind of counteract the orange music from last week. Anyway, I will be back with more thoughts next week. This is Adam.
Right, this is one of those cases where more than ever before, in view of our new hostile audience, I have to do a balancing act. Weighing on the one hand that new hostile audience, and on the other hand the fact that when there is something that does need to be discussed and disseminated to the widest possible circles in our tiny little community, Radio Free Northwest is the best and fastest way to do it, because of our syndication at ANN and the upsurge in our own direct download and listening audience, thanks to recent publicity. It's a coin toss. Now let's just hope the coin comes down with the right side up. There's something interesting about this clip. I have, in fact, personally met neither of the two comrades in question, and that is, in some respects, as it should be. Now, I know that a lot of you guys, possibly most of you, probably think that I'm being paranoid or a drama queen, or I'm somehow playing for sympathy of some kind, or whatever. But I will tell you again, I am not going to be with you forever. And you are going to have to learn how to do things without me, without reference to me, without my personal hands-on involvement on your own initiative. I am not the King of England, and the touch of my hands does not cure scrofula. Nowhere is it chiseled in stone that I have to know personally every single comrade here in the Northwest homeland, or personally write a permission slip for every small action. I should be able to wake up in the morning, sit down at my computer, log on, and go to MyNorthwest.com or Drudge or local news sources in anticipation. I wonder what the boys got up to last night. I'm glad these two took the initiative to get together on their own without any reference to me. Our movement has a long history of fearless leaders who try to micromanage everything out of ego and also, frankly, out of nervous fear that their people might plot against them or do something that makes the dictatorship really mad to the point they'll fuck with fearless leader. I'm sure some names come to mind for some of you. I'm not like that. I've made it clear that I don't want you doing stupid nonsense, like shooting up nigger churches or burning down nigger churches or playing pranks on niggers generally, but I have been waiting with bated breath for many years for the concept of individual initiative to make its appearance. How we have a race to save and a nation to found, people, you don't need to wait for an engraved invitation from me. That having been said, it's true that I did redact the section from that brief audio clip where Adam wanted me to shout his email address to the four winds. He's young and enthusiastic, and he's never been involved before, and so he clearly doesn't understand what can happen. Now, this leads into another topic, or another one of those toss-ups. Do I discuss it in public, so as to bring as large a number of legitimate people as possible into the discussion? Or do I clam up so that the nasties won't get ideas? Well, we can't walk on eggshells forever. At some point in time, we're all going to have to start taking at least a few risks. And the first step to that is talking about risky things. Now, I'm referring to the email contacts I used to send out to the Northwest Revolution List. I think I sent out the last one in April, but it had been pretty much dying on the vine for a while before that. Basically, the idea is that people agree to list their email addresses as well as their state and locality, on this privately circulated list with a view towards taking the first step off the internet and back into the real world by physically meeting with other white nationalists in their areas. I've been doing this off and on for almost 5 years now, and the results have been mixed. There have been a few good meets that have been reported back to me, and there have been a lot of no-shows and complete non-responses, although so far, no really bad incidents or breaches. I'm always saddened and disappointed by the tiny, tiny number of individuals off our email roster of many thousands of people who are willing to take even that first little tiny baby step out from behind the computer. It's bad. I purge lurkers periodically, but they keep creeping back on. Now my question is, would there be any interest in reviving this list? If so, let me hear from you. I think I made my attitude toward the Confederate flag thing going on in the South pretty clear in the July 11th call-in show. But one comrade suggested that I devote the musical section of this show towards Confederate music. One of the most disgraceful things that's been happening has been that the city of Memphis is digging up the graves of a man whom military historians believe may have been the finest light cavalry commander in history, General Nathan Bedford Forrest and his wife, and making off with whatever's left in the graves after 100 years or more. But like South Carolina and Mississippi, Memphis is now a nigger city, so what the hell do you expect? Anyway, this is Bobby Horton.
The day of our destiny was darkened. The heart of the nation stood still when Forts Henry and Donelson surrendered and Johnston fell back to Nashville. But the clouds which then thickened all around us served only the plainer to show the form of that hero arising to deliver us all from the foe. Here's to Forrest from the brave Tennessee. Here's to Forrest from the brave Tennessee. In our hearts he will triumph forever. Here's to Forrest from the brave Tennessee. At Shiloh he charged a division, uncovered our army's retreat. At Murfreesboro won his promotion when Crittenden admitted his defeat. Next straight went careering before him, expecting our rear to assail. But Forrest with his fair maiden pilot soon landed the robber in jail. Here's to Forrest from the brave Tennessee. Here's to Forrest from the brave Tennessee. In our hearts he will triumph forever. Here's to Forrest from the brave Tennessee. Chickamauga, Chattanooga, Oklahoma, Memphis and Tishomingo Creek, Union City, Fort Pillow and Paducah, all the deeds of our hero bespeak. Now Athens, Sulphur Springs and Pulaski have aroused old Sherman from his lair. For the boldest of Yankee commanders will tremble with Forrest in his rear. Here's to Forrest from the brave Tennessee. Here's to Forrest from the brave Tennessee. In our hearts he will triumph forever. Here's to Forrest from the brave Tennessee. Next, Johnsonville attracted his attention, where Sherman had collected his stores, and the gunboats once terrible to mention loaded grandly and proudly at his doors. But Forrest's artillery battalion, Morton Rice and Walton and Thrall, set fire to Sherman's gunboats and transports, nor ceased till they had burned
I am utterly determined that the life and work and murder of Edgar J. Steele will not be forgotten. As often as I can possibly swing it, I am going to thrust Edgar Steele right in the face of those who are listening and who are responsible for his murder. This is the first part of an interview that Ed Steele did after his conviction, and he's doing this by phone from the jailhouse in Bonner County, Idaho.
Joining me on the line is Edgar J. Steele from the Bonner County Sheriff's Jail. This is Ed's first interview while he's in jail. Ed, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here. As you said, this is the first interview that I've given since I was arrested almost a year ago, and I'm glad to have it be with AFP.
Many people are in your corner, and they want to get you out of there. We're going to do whatever we can, obviously, within the law to make sure that happens.
Well, I know that, and I tell you, I can't say thank you enough to all the people who have contributed money, who have sent good wishes, who have attended court hearings and trial, just everybody, all my new friends and my old friends. I've been overwhelmed by this, and it's been a real eye-opener for me. They say in jail that if you want to find out who your real friends are, just go to jail, because most of the people here find that the vast majority, if not all of their family, turns their back on them, that their friends turn their backs on them, that former co-workers turn their backs on them. And I can't tell you how many guys are just dead lonely sitting in jail and prison cells who feel betrayed by those who should not have left them, because you also would be amazed to learn how many of these people are actually innocent. In my case, however, I can't think of a single friend, not one single family member. I can't think of anybody who's turned their back on me, and I've been amazed and gratified. I thank you all very much.
Why don't you, for the benefit of our listeners, whatever you can talk about, I don't know if there's anything that you can't talk about, but the trial that just happened and the jury's decision, obviously most people who are listening to this broadcast are familiar with the result of that, but can you give the listeners any insight into why you think it may have unfolded the way it did?
Oh, I can, and I will, and I'll be honest with you, Dave, I can't think of anything that I'm not willing to talk about. So if you've got tough questions, please ask them. Tougher the better. How did it happen? Well, the trial was rigged to begin with, just like the recordings that I'm alleged to have participated in with Larry the Idahan Hitman. The trial was rigged from start to finish, and I saw that even in the pretrial hearings. Now, the judge hears about this. He ain't going to be happy with me. Well, that's life. That's my opinion, and I'm entitled to it. And I think I can prove it, and I'm going to prove it to you right now. The first inkling that I had that things were going to be really bad was when the government filed a motion saying that they should be allowed to invade my attorney-client privilege. I was astounded to see the judge rule in their favor, and they were allowed to listen in on my private attorney-client conversations with lawyers that I was consulting about my case that I had not retained, and with retained lawyers. They were allowed to listen in and make transcripts of those conversations. The prosecutor, Tracy Whalen, even bragged to my then public defender, Roger Peaven, that she knew all of our trial strategy as she cackled wildly. I was astounded, because he came to me and he was very angry. And rightly so, because he had learned for the first time that the feds had transcripts of my conversations with every other lawyer I had spoken to, that they had copies of letters that I had sent to and received from other lawyers. Apparently, the state thinks that it has the right to invade the attorney-client privilege of anybody who isn't the actual single attorney of record, and you're only allowed one. That ain't the law. I know it for a fact. I've read these cases. That isn't what it says. Yes, there are some Ninth Federal Circuit, which is the appellate level above this district court in Idaho, and that sits in San Francisco. There are some cases that say in limited circumstances there can be a waiver of the attorney-client privilege when one knows that one's telephone conversation is being recorded, that you thereby essentially assent to it being recorded and listened into. That's not the case in my case. First of all, I had asked the jailers if there was another phone that I could use so that I could talk to my attorneys privately without other inmates around me listening. And they said no. I had to use one of the four telephones there in the Spokane County Jail where I was then incarcerated and nothing else. When you call an attorney on that phone, or if you call anybody, it will tell you that it's subject to monitoring. It doesn't say it's being recorded. It says it's subject to. And there is a written jail policy, which supposedly governs this, that says that telephone conversations will not be recorded unless there is a court order for such. There was never any such court order issued in my case. Therefore, I felt confident that my conversations with attorneys, that my correspondence with attorneys, was privileged. Well, after I had a lot of it, and after I had discussed everything about my case that was possible to discuss with other attorneys, either by mail or by telephone, then I learned that they weren't privileged. Because that's when the judge ruled that the federal prosecutors could listen in and have transcripts of all those conversations, save only my public defender. Now, that may seem like a long answer, but the question you've asked is really the single question about my case. And I could sit here and carry on for an hour or two easily in fully answering the question. You can log on to the Federal District Court's website, and somewhere on there you will find the motion papers for this pretrial motion about invading attorney-client privilege. Read it. Read them both. You'll be amazed. That's the first inkling that I had that something was, well, that wasn't the first one. I mean, the day I was arrested was my first inkling. The second one really came several months later when this motion was heard and the judge ruled that the prosecution had the right to listen in to my attorney-client telephone calls and also to duplicate letters between me and other lawyers, except only my appointed public defender. And that really sucks, particularly since I didn't find out about it until after I had already extensively discussed everything that had to do with my case. We walked into trial at a serious disadvantage. And that wasn't even the worst one. Here's the worst one. 4 days prior to trial, we had a hearing about experts, my experts. I had two sound experts set up to testify. They came into that courtroom. They sat in that witness chair and took up the better part of 2 days of testimony. We took longer offering up our experts than we took in presenting my defense, because my defense went down in less than a day, and I'll tell you later why it didn't take any longer than that. It didn't take any longer than that because it couldn't take any longer than that, and I've got two people to thank for that, the judge and my lawyer. So, there we have two experts sitting on the witness stand testifying about these two audio tapes. The two audio tapes that are just too good to be true. And I say they're too good to be true, and maybe another time or even later in this recording we can talk about why they're too good to be true, but I maintain that all you have to do is listen to them and consider how inflammatory and outrageous they are, and what are the chances that something like that could have been recorded. Think back over recordings you've heard of in other cases, the actual recordings, and think how hit and miss they have been. The recordings in my case are perfect. They are complete. They are inflammatory. They have motive. They have opportunity. They have method. They are absolutely complete unto themselves, each of the two of them. And because there are two, they thereby supposedly corroborate one another. And there is corroboration on these recordings as well. It is amazing how bad they are. When I first heard them, I became physically ill. That's how good they are. I became convinced by my public defender that it actually was me on the tapes. I became convinced that I'd had these conversations, and I have no memory of it because I must have a split personality. Eddie and Hyde, I called it, because it was funny. And those who have followed my readings know that I like to bend even gallows humor into something personal. Eddie and Hyde, the classic split personality. I honestly believed it. Of course, I was still under the influence, extensively, of post-surgical drugs. I'd had four major surgeries in the handful of months that preceded the day of my arrest, something we can go into at another time. There are many aspects to this case. So for an extended period of time, I about 90% believed that I had really spoken on those tapes. My public defender went to great lengths to convince me of that. I became predictably very depressed because, again, those who have followed my writings know how devoted I am to my family, know how much I love my wife, Cindy, and I do, 26 years, and I sure wish I could get out of here and start our next 26 years together. I love that woman more than I can say. There is no way, absolutely no way, I would want to harm her. I would lay down my life for her in a heartbeat. And those who know me know that that's true. And that's one of the reasons that I haven't lost any friends throughout this exercise. Now, it was only a couple, 3 months prior to trial when my new lawyer, the private lawyer that I was paying out of my pocket, because finally the government returned the silver, my life savings that they had seized, they returned it, I was able to hire a lawyer. That lawyer was able to get a sound expert who analyzed the recording and got two experts, in fact, and they both came up with the same result. There was an extraordinary, their word, not mine, an extraordinary number of anomalies, of problems with those two recordings. One of those experts who had 30 or 40 years of experience in dealing with recordings, beginning with police department back east, and now has his own company doing just that, analyzing recordings, said that there were 351 of what he called electronic transient signatures. And he could distinguish between electronic and auditory signatures, i.e. anomalies or little noises on the tape that you can't even hear most of them. You can't even begin to hear them if you just listen to them, but you can see them if you put the waveform up on a scope. He said the difference between electronic and auditory is that the fall-off is almost instantaneous with electronic, whereas auditory, like dropping a pen on the floor or something, sets up echoes, some of which you absolutely cannot hear, but which get picked up on a recording, and that's how you can tell the difference. 351 electronic signature transients he picked up on just one of the tapes. And the other fellow, using a different program, didn't come up with that many. I think he came up with 50-plus. But both of them agreed that it was more than they had ever seen on a similar tape. Both of them agreed that it was an extraordinary number. The one who had the 30 years experience with the police department and in his own company now went even further. He said in his opinion, there's no question but what the tapes were false, that they had been edited. And furthermore, by analyzing the waveforms closely, he had determined that in many places on the tape, the voice purported to be mine isn't even my voice. Somebody else had said the words, and they had used readily available sound morphing technology to make it sound like my voice. And I understand that there's a recording up on the website freeedgarsteele.com. I think there are dashes in between the words that people can listen to where somebody has allegedly used sound morphing technology in 5 minutes flat and produced something that is astoundingly like what sounds like me. The second expert, with all the police department experience, said it wasn't even my voice in a lot of places on these tapes. The first expert had more credentials. He's a true doctorate. He works for the Los Alamos labs for the U.S. government, has done for years investigations and forensic analysis of tapes like this. Remember, he's one of the guys who said it was an extraordinary number of electronic signature transients on the tape. He was more careful, and he wouldn't go so far as to say that it wasn't my voice, because there's no way that he felt he could say that with a certainty. And he didn't go so far as to say with a certainty that the tapes had been fabricated. He did say it was an extraordinary number of transients, and that the transients were exactly what you would get if there had been splices, clips, electronic alterations to the recording. He noted that you can also get those electronic transients by doing things like turning a microphone on and off, and there's no allegation that that occurred during these recordings, by an equipment malfunction. There's no allegation of that about the recorder that was used to make these recordings, and one or two other things that are even more unlikely than those two. That doesn't leave much. What it leaves is somebody went in there and made these tapes. And when I heard that, such a relief washed over me. Because then I knew that Eddie and Hyde didn't exist. Then I knew that the tapes had been fabricated. Then I knew that I hadn't, in a drug stupor, somehow or other, hallucinated myself into a place where I believed that my wife deserved to die. That is another significant step in this case that told me something was seriously wrong. So, you know, like they say, you're not paranoid if they actually are out to get you. Or you may be paranoid, but that doesn't mean they're not out to get you. In my case, they're out to get me.
Country's flag, rally boys, nor do not lag, come from every vale and crag, sons of liberty. Northern band who tread our soil, forth they come for blood and spoil, to the homes we've gained with toil, shouting slavery. Lincoln's bloody band now invades the free man's land, armed with sword and firebrand, against the brave and free. Arm ye then for fray and fight, march ye forth both day and night, stop not till the foes inside, sons of chivalry. The blood still flows of brave men who once arose, burst the shackles of their foes, honest men and free. Rise then in your power and might, seek the spoil of brave fight, strike for God, for truth, for right, strike for liberty.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'd like to talk about Beyond Human Rights, Defending Freedoms by Alan D. Benoist. Now this is a treatise on the history and philosophy behind the present religion of human rights. In Western culture, prior to Christianity, you had Roman law, and in these times there was little social interest in individuals per se, although an individual might earn respect with significant merit. With the coming of Christianity, you had a concern for individual salvation, which anyone could attain. Now, at one point in church history, there was a need for Franciscan orders to own property in order to build a monastery. Now, Franciscans in particular have a strong need to be poor, so St. Thomas Aquinas came up with nominalism to stress individualism in particular. So the Franciscans could buy monastery property with far less guilt with regard to their very strong vow of poverty. Also, you had an idea promoted by the Spanish scholastics, which questioned the once popular medieval idea of social hierarchy, claiming that this preordered nature restricted God's sovereignty. Even so, when these ideas started to migrate to philosophy around the time of the French Revolution, the Church did not embrace the secularization of these concepts. In fact, in 1789, they were actually condemned by Pope Pius VI. Pope Leo XIII softened on the matter, and actually in the mid-1940s, Pope John XXIII actually embraced the idea of human rights, and these philosophies of human rights also accelerated after Vatican II. However, this is not to create the impression that human rights is a religious ideology. Since in modern times, these ideas have progressed to notions not dependent on religion. The difficulty in determining the philosophical basis for human rights is that there are multiple points of departure, depending on whether you're discussing it from a philosophical or a religious background. In Asia, and particularly in places like China and India, there's really no proper translation for the term human rights. The only words you can find are words such as right action and dharma. In the West, there are more secular notions having to do with reason, dignity, or ideas of self-sufficiency stemming from a pre-existing idea of natural law. Also, to a Western theist, an argument can be made that a person may know God, and thus, really, you have a situation where even though a practical accord is possible, a practical agreement on human rights, a theological or a theoretical accord is really impossible because really no basis would suit everyone. But it is held together by a consensual vision, an idea of a better tomorrow, and a collective destiny. The author points out that in modernity, one of the things that the law has started to do is that from time to time it has abandoned the principle of non-retroactivity. This is a situation where something occurs. Either it occurs or it is alleged to have occurred, for example, as in the case with the Nuremberg trials, and then a law is made and it is retroactively applied. So the other thing is you have the question of the universality of human rights. Does it dissolve culture or is it dissolved by culture? This notion of human rights, again, it's only a very recent notion, and it's a notion of an inherent right or a right that is possessed by individuals, which is not owing to the natural order of things. So when I say natural law in this type of context or natural rights, in terms of a human rights concept, you're not talking, of course, about Darwinism or Dharma, but you're talking about a notion of rights that was conceived by philosophers like Locke and Hobbes. Because this started only around the time of the French Revolution, it's actually an uncommon idea, even in Western culture, because when you look at cultures such as Auxotrophe, for example, you have a holistic culture, you have notions of obligation and reciprocity, and they're really a present. And you have a notion of individuality connecting with social relationships and order and natural harmony. While the author says that human nature does exist, it's hard to discern. In modernity, this notion also contributes to the idea of homo economicus, and that is the notion of people being interchangeable. The author also notes that in general, more personal autonomy also equals a stronger government. Respect is given to any and all choices, unless, of course, the person ends up being a white nationalist or national socialist, something like that. Now, also, these modern natural rights are not social. These natural rights can predominate over positive rights, and those are rights conferred by citizenship. Now, there's even some people in Western culture today that would like non-citizens to be able to vote. This, of course, only applies to non-whites. I would not be able to go to Europe and vote for a nationalist party, for example, in a country where I was not a citizen. The author talks about something which has come about in more recent years, and these are second-generation rights, and these are social rights, rights to education, work, and medical care. Now, to the author, social rights are more credible than individual rights, and the author also reminds us that democracy is not the same as human rights, although these ideas are often paired, whereas a notion of human rights is a moral notion. The notion of democracy is a political one, and of course, universal voting rights, if they were conferred to anyone and everyone, would impede sovereignty. The author prefers civic republicanism or commentarian schools to avoid abuse and tyranny, which the author is actually against. But the author does not prefer liberal thought, which he finds really too abstract. This book is a dry read, so don't read it when you're tired, and make sure that really if you're going to be reading it, you've got to be very awake. Now, I have been requested to read Kemp's The March of the Titans. That's going to be a very long book. So if I dare to embark on that book, if I do that next, I'm going to have to read that in sections. I really doubt there's any way I'm going to report on such a long book in one MP3. So I hope you enjoyed this review, and I thank you very much for listening. And hail victory, comrades.
This is Kathy Matea.
Bob Roebuck is my sweetheart's name. He's off to the wars and gone. He's fighting for his nanny dear. His sword is buckled on. He's fighting for his own true love. His foes he does defy. He is the darling of my heart, my southern soldier boy. Should he fall in this
Recently, I mentioned that some of our comrades asked me on occasion, Harold, when are we going to get to the fun part? I always answer that there simply isn't any specific date that can be set. That depends entirely on external factors and world events which are completely beyond our control. A Northwest independence will come when certain conditions combine to create a window of opportunity, which we must then be in a position to exploit here in the homeland, kind of a harmonic convergence type of thing. Then, when dealing with this question, I usually go on to talk about the revolutionary tripod, the three social and political requirements necessary for actual change in this country, that is, the existence of a bona fide revolutionary party, the withdrawal of the consent of the governed, and the loss of the credible monopoly of armed force on the part of the dictatorship. Now, recently, one of our more eager beavers asked me to get into all this again, but rather than just repeat all the stuff I've said before, okay, I'll speculate a little deeper. Now, this time it's not total crystal ball gazing. There's a purpose in it, because you people out there who will, let me repeat that, who will by then have created an actual functioning party on the ground here in the Pacific Northwest, will need to recognize that window of opportunity when it arrives, and most likely I won't be here to help. You guys are almost certainly going to have to pull this off without me, so you damned well better listen up while I'm still around. You will need clearly to observe a number of signs and portents, as our Bible-punching brethren would say, social and economic and political indicators which are not just passing phases, but which constitute long-term deteriorations in the fabric of American society, and which degrade the operating capability of the dictatorship to the point where it's vulnerable. It needs to be clear that these conditions have become permanent, are not reversible, and will not be reversed. First off, American cities as a whole must become largely dysfunctional and uninhabitable for white people because they're simply too physically unsafe and whites are too vulnerable to racial violence from the blacks and the browns. Now, that's already happening, as we can tell just by looking at Drudge Report. This has to include the previously safe ring suburbs to which the white population has fled from diversity. There'll be a few places like Washington, D.C., and Manhattan and San Francisco and a few other urban areas where the dictatorship will maintain what amounts to fortified high-tech enclaves which are necessary to the functioning of the machine. Washington, D.C. for government, Manhattan for banking and finance, San Francisco, Silicon Valley, and maybe a few other enclaves, and perhaps Houston for technology. There will also probably be large stretches of New England and Northern Virginia that will be turned into a kind of green zone as kind of bedroom suburbs for the Morlocks. Yeah, that's another word that I'm trying to insert into our vocabulary. It comes from H.G. Wells' novel, The Time Machine. In this case, it refers to the small elite of scientific, technical, financial, and administrative white people who are maintained today and who will be maintained by what I suppose might be called the Soylent Green State in order to keep the machinery working, both metallic machinery in the technical sense and the paper machinery in the administrative sense. Now, that will be the deal that the system makes with the last white people. They exchange high-level labor and maintenance of the system in return for physical safety, and of course the last of the consumer luxuries in the world of Soylent Green. If you've seen a recent movie called Elysium, basically this country will become dotted with Elysiums, not space stations, but fortified enclaves of the kind that I refer to here, mostly in or around the large cities, where a lot of the remaining power, money, and technology is concentrated. Now, incidentally, there may well be one of these high-tech and high-security enclaves here in Seattle, at the heart of Big Bill's empire. Unless, of course, Big Bill ups stakes and moves to Canada, like he's been threatening to do if the regime doesn't allow him an endless supply of macacas. But, by and large, pretty much all of America's top 100 urban areas are going to be in various stages of Detroitification from now on, a process which is already beginning and which has accelerated rapidly since 2009, with the result that there will be large numbers of the remaining white people, millions of them, who will be seeking refuge from their now uninhabitable homes in the ring suburbs. Now, many of them will only flee about 70 or 100 miles down the road to what's becoming known as the exurbs. But a significant number of them will flee to the Pacific Northwest. Now, that will mean that there will be a sudden influx of pissed-off whites into the Pacific Northwest, lots of them. You guys will need to use that against the dictatorship. The next thing we need to watch for is some kind of financial crisis or possibly some kind of technical glitch in the computers, which means that the dictator's servants no longer get paid, specifically their gun toters. Now, I've spoken in the past about some major collapse or takedown of the EBT system when all of a sudden, one morning on the first of the month, there's no money on the cards, and you've got 50 million rioting niggers and Mexicans, and yes, that could be one of the triggering events for all of this, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about some kind of probably quite sudden and unexpected degradation of the power structure's financial capability so that the men, and yes, it's the men we're concerned with here, so that the men who carry the pistols on their hips and in their shoulder holsters, the men with the shotguns and the AR assault rifles in their trunks, the men in the black body armor who have the legal authority to kill and imprison anyone who opposes the dictatorship, all of a sudden, they themselves are not getting paid, and their families and children, if any, are doing without. Or else the money with which they're being paid is worthless and won't buy anything. Now, to cops and federal law enforcement, that's a deal breaker. The deal was that they carry the guns for the dictatorship and use them on order against whoever Barry or Hillary points their finger at. In return, the dictator provides the Folding Green and the physical safety and the weekend trips to Six Flags for the kids. When the dictator ceases to hold up her end of the bargain, so will they. And that goes for cops and gun thugs of all races. This isn't even a racial thing, it's about money. Now, it costs a pretty penny for the dictator to maintain this huge army of men and guns in order to force Americans to submit and obey. The last I heard, a rookie FBI agent just out of Quantico started up at $62,000 a year. And that was some years ago, so it's probably gone up since then. Plus full medical coverage for themselves and their families, and I don't mean down at the local clinic where the doctors are all just off the jumbo jet from Indonesia and none of them speak English. In many cases, the medical and dental plan is an even bigger attraction than the money, which, considering the crushing and bankrupting cost of a single emergency room visit these days, isn't too surprising. Now, that's why they stay loyal, so long as those direct deposits hit their bank accounts every 2 weeks and so long as the money will buy stuff. Most senior FBI and other secret police functionaries pull down well into six figures, and as I mentioned a while ago, that means that federal law enforcement officers are among the few remaining privileged categories of people who can enjoy what's left of the consumer world from the 1970s and 1980s. Now, local cops obviously aren't as well off as their FBI colleagues, but the same principle holds true. A police officer has a steady paycheck in a time when very few people have that. He has some degree of job security, unless, of course, he gets videotaped whooping up on a nigger. His paycheck is reasonably generous by today's standards and reasonably secure, although there have been cases when municipal police departments have had to go for a couple of weeks without getting paid, and there will be more of those in the future. The cop has health care coverage of some kind, although I have heard of smaller departments being forced onto Obamacare. And the local cop can usually afford to buy some kind of small house in a reasonably safe suburb, not the hoity-toity wealthy neighborhood that the FBI man can buy into in some little enclave of senior civil servants, but certainly a hell of a lot better than the overwhelming majority of white people, many of whom are now living in ticky-tacky apartments, double wides, or under a bridge. This is why I talk so much about FBI and police and so forth on this show. They are an integral and vitally important part of the problem. They are absolutely essential to the continuation of the existing order. America rules by force, especially since November the 20th, 2014, when the Constitution was suspended and the people's elected representatives did nothing to defend it. Now the dictator rules through the stroke of his pen and the guns on the hips of those who take his money. Without these hundreds of thousands of men, yes, men, and the firearms in their hands, Obama wouldn't last a week and Hillary wouldn't dare show her face in public, even with the media roped off like cattle. So that's another one of the indicators we need to watch for, which will warn us that our window of opportunity for quote-unquote the fun part is here. When the American goon squads haven't been getting their direct deposits or else they're getting paid in worthless scrip, and a loaf of bread costs $12 and a pound of hamburger $40, and the only grocery store in town that still has any food in it won't take government scrip. When those who carry guns to uphold the dictatorship and carry out the dictator's will lay aside their guns to fend for themselves because the dictator isn't keeping up her end of the deal. Now that's our window. Killing and dying costs money, and when the direct deposits stop, as far as federal agents and cops are concerned, so does the killing and dying. I want to close out with one last quick comment. This is from an idiot heckler a week or so ago, whose comment, needless to say, I did not approve, and his, her, or its heckle went roughly like this.
Nyeh, 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 your beloved Confederacy and the Third Reich lost. Bleh.
Now, I know this sometimes kind of bothers a lot of us. I know it sure as hell bothers me. I just get so sick of bad people winning all the time. Now, it's true that the South and Nazi Germany did lose. Yes, but, and this is an important but, which all of us need to remember. In 1861 and 1941, the Confederacy and the Third Reich, through a combination of political blundering and Jewish conspiracy, the real kind, ended up facing the United States at the top of its game for each century. By the standard of both eras, a massive industrial power for the time that could outproduce the Southerners and the Germans in everything that mattered. Weapons, munitions, uniforms and equipment, supplies, boots, food, so forth and so on. And in the case of the North, during the Civil War, there was a far superior rail transportation and telegraphic communications network in place. Not to mention that the Union states greatly outnumbered the Confederate states in population and wealth. The South had no navy, the Germans were fighting off the entire world on about 12 fronts, so forth and so on. But today, the United States of America is no longer anywhere near the top of its game and hasn't been for decades. We don't manufacture hardly anything anymore in this country. Our roads and power grids and highways and other infrastructure are crumbling away. There are 95 million adults unemployed as I speak, and many of the rest are working 29.5 hours per week so that the employer doesn't have to fuck with Obamacare. The politics and the culture of the United States have lapsed pretty much into outright insanity, and just about everybody is incredibly wretched and miserable. No one is going to fight to the death to defend a country and a society that gives them nothing but wretchedness and misery, except for a small minority of completely amoral people who will fight and kill for money. When the money runs out, then it's our turn. As they say in Belfast, chucky ar la. That's another one of those Irish expressions I wish I could get Americans to wrap their cholesterol-clogged minds around. It means our day will come. But for now, the end of this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest has come. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom. Thank you.